Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the stealth takeover of eastern and southern Ukraine, led by Russia's military intelligence, the GRU, and special forces, the Spetsnaz, and look into the extent to which the U.S. intelligence community was caught flat-footed by Putin's snatch of Crimea and now his shadow invasion of Ukraine. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who analyzes intelligence for CNN, joins us to discuss the successful destabilization of Ukraine by Putin and why U.S. intelligence appears to have missed the real invasion while focusing on the deployment of Russia's conventional army near Ukraine's border. Then we'll get a further analysis of President Obama's foreign policy, which came into focus recently when the president defended his record in response to criticism from a Fox News reporter. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to discuss the apparent disconnect in the polls that show only 19% of Americans want a more aggressive and interventionist foreign policy, while at the same time expressing unhappiness that the U.S. is not doing more to help the victims of aggression in Syria and Ukraine. Then finally, we will speak with Nigerian citizen journalist Omoyele Sowore, the founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com, about the international protests in support of the 223 kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria who are being held by the Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram, which translated means Western education is sinful. We will examine the corrupt Nigerian government's inability to prevent the kidnappings and hunt down the kidnappers, and assess the state of security in Nigeria on the eve of a global economic forum on Africa that world leaders, including China's president, are expected to attend. Joining us now is Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is now an intelligence analyst at CNN and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's good to be back.
And clearly there's been a stealth takeover of eastern Ukraine and now southern Ukraine, at least hasn't happened yet, but it's underway, led by Russia's military intelligence, the GRU, and the special forces, the Spetsnaz. And it does seem that the U.S. intelligence community was caught flat-footed by Putin's snatch of Crimea and now his shadow invasion of Ukraine. What's your understanding of why we missed it? I mean, did Putin pull this feint of deploying that big army on the border, and that's what we focused on while he was, you know, surreptitiously moving his GRU and Spetsnaz in?
Well, Ian, I think what we've got to look back at is there was no intelligence there was going to be an invasion of the Ukraine or Crimea. I talked to somebody in Secretary Kerry's office who said there was not anything suggesting they were preparing an invasion. When he was talking to Lavrov, that is Kerry, Lavrov assured him that there would be no invasion, the Russians weren't involved. That, of course, turned out to be a lie. But the point is, Kerry accepted that in the absence of good intelligence. I think what we have to look at here is that the Russians are determined to keep, one, the Ukraine out of NATO. And to do that, or falling under Western influence to do that, they'll invade. You know, there was an agreement between Russia and the United States going back to the mid-90s that we wouldn't take in former Soviet Union countries into NATO or really have basing agreements in Eastern Europe. We've broken that, and in Putin's eyes, he's justified in doing what he's doing. You know, I think that the Russians at the end of the day are determined to protect ethnic Russians. Wherever they may be. That's sort of a fixed policy of Putin's. And they don't care about sanctions. They don't care about anything. And I'd be very surprised if at this point they back off.
Well, so what do you think, though, is happening in the south there, where Russian forces have in Transnistria, which is an enclave in Moldova, that's actually a lawless gun-running enclave run by criminals, just as South Ossetia and Abkhazia are the two parts that Putin carved off Georgia when that ill-fated move by the Georgians led to a Russian and Georgian war. It would seem that by moving into Odessa and moving from the west to the east, from Moldova across to Crimea, it looks as if Putin is trying to literally encircle Ukraine.
Oh, I think it's a done deal. Ian, I hate to do this, but we have to go back into ancient history, and that's 1991. We, you know, the first Bush administration sort of deluded itself, and Americans deluded themselves in that the Russian Empire had collapsed. But in fact, through the Caucasus and Central Asia, their intelligence services and the army continued to control things. I was assigned out there. I mean, I was spent time with the Russian army. I watched them. In total disregard of the locals, they would move to protect Russians or whatever they thought their interests were. So, you know, I think half of this is our fault, that we didn't understand the game afoot, or we refused to understand it. So, yeah, he's going to go into Moldova. He could even go into the Baltics if things got bad.
Surely he's got his hands full with Ukraine. I mean, this is a tinderbox that could explode at any moment, and we've seen that. And Odessa is not one of those places that is entirely like the East, where there's a lot of pro-Russian sentiment. It's pretty mixed there, and so it seems that that this could break out into a serious conflict.
That's what he wants. He needs a conflict. He needs to have even the Europeans throw up their hands, say, well, you know, better have the Russians taking control than a complete civil war. So I think, you know, the evidence is fairly good that he's in fact provoking the conflict and needs dead Russians in order to move in to the Ukraine to justify it. His popularity is gone through the ceiling. And internationally, he's got this plausible deniability. It's a polite fiction. No, we're not doing anything. But at the end of the day, what are the Europeans going to do? They need Russian gas. They need somebody to control the Ukraine because they don't have an army to do it. We don't have a single tank, for instance, United States and Germany. And what are we going to do about it? Nothing. I mean, you know, we play checkers. He plays chess. You know, I think it's fairly clear now.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, who's a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon, and is now an intelligence analyst at CNN and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. But isn't there another possibility that the country could actually be split along the Dnieper River, the east, the west going to Ukraine and the east going to Russia? I don't see the idea of if Putin were able to invade the whole country, he's pretty much effectively taken the east, and now he's in the process of moving into the south. If he takes the whole country, he's going to have a guerrilla war on his hands, isn't he?
I can't tell you who could win it, but I suggest the Russians might. And you're right, he could just simply annex the eastern part, which is already an egregious violation of international law. Who knows what goes on in his mind? Certainly American intelligence doesn't. But, you know, his plan may be to, yes, annex the east and put a friendly government in the western part of the country. Fairly friendly, you know.
So why do you think, I've talked to some intelligence people in Washington and tried to get to the bottom of why the U.S. was caught flat-footed. One of the things I was told was that this is a result of Edward Snowden providing the Russians with information about NSA and other capabilities, and that GRU and Spetsnaz went dark. And that's how they were able to snatch Crimea and move in and stealthily take over the east of Ukraine.
Well, I think it'd be Snowden would have known with what he stole or what he downloaded, whatever you want to call it, he would have known what Russian military communications were being monitored, whether it was looking at simply frequency analysis or simply listening to them. He would have known that, and he would have been in a position to let the Russians know where their vulnerabilities were. Can anybody prove that? I'm sure there's an investigation that has pieces of this pointing one way or another, but yes, you're absolutely right. The Russians know what they can get away with and know when we can intercept them and when we can't, yes.
But this obviously the point that was made to me was that there's been a change, that previously they had the ability to watch them in real time, and now they were. Well, you said that Kerry is complaining.
He was totally surprised, Ian. I assure you that. I have no doubt about my source. There was no one handed him any chatter. Look, this could happen. If that chatter, they did intercept some. Certainly didn't get to the Secretary of State where it should have gone. So, yes, it was a total surprise.
So what then is going on with the U.S. intelligence? I noticed that the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and his deputy are stepping down. Reports are that they were trying to reform the DIA, which is kind of a bit of a boondoggle. They wanted to move into new areas like cyber defense, etc., and they came up against bureaucratic resistance. That's one explanation. The other explanation is that General Flynn was too abrasive, which is kind of an absurd idea. That's required. I mean, isn't that a requirement in the military to be abrasive? I mean, so do you have any understanding?
Well, Flynn wanted to start collecting intelligence using human sources, and he wanted to establish himself in competition with the CIA. But in a battle with John Brennan, the CIA director, it was one he was doomed to lose. The military doesn't do well with human sources, never has. Military officers don't like to do it, best don't go into it. It all sorts of reasons it doesn't work. But the point is, Flynn was telegraphing that our intelligence isn't very good if he wanted to set up a rival agency. But human intelligence went away thanks to drones. The entire intelligence community was jump tracks to drones and drone assassinations.
So when you say that Brennan won this round, what was Brennan doing in Kiev recently? I mean, my understanding was that he...
I don't know, Ian. He's promising better intelligence, letting us know what the Russians are doing, so forth.
Right, but isn't the entire Ukrainian government, intelligence service, the country itself is completely penetrated by...
Absolutely. They're running circles around us, totally running circles around us.
Well, to the point where they apparently took over some roadblocks from Ukrainian military by sending in, local people offering food to these soldiers, these Ukrainian soldiers who are ill-equipped and ill-fed. And apparently they put sleeping potion in the food
and then stole
their weapons.
I just don't know. I can't tell you. But I don't see how we can win this one. We can't win it with intelligence. We can't win it with covert assets. And Putin has a determination.
Well, but it also seems like the Ukrainians are incompetent. I mean, obviously, there's no real government. That's why they want to have this election on May the 25th that Putin seems determined to stop. I mean, it's a country beset by corruption. Even the prime minister in visiting Odessa today said that it blamed the police for being corrupt. It's difficult for me to see who's got a lock on corruption. You've got, Putin's little...
Look, Russia is a corrupt state. They've combined this whole idea of the mafia with national security, where it's sort of inseparable. I mean, getting control of the power ministries in Russia means making money. Putin is one of the richest men in the world. I have no doubt about it. And he doesn't see any. He believes it's a right that once you get into power, you get to steal. But you also, it's an obligation to project Russian national interests. And he's completely mixed those up in a way we can't understand. but we can see the effect.
Well, the effect is certainly manifest in Russia itself, where Putin is a hero. I mean, May Day parades with adulation, and there's this, you know, fairly fervent nationalism underway, which, you know, it's so strange when we live in a universe where the former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is criticizing the move of NATO eastward, and yet Democratic presidents and national security officials are responsible for it. I mean, it's
we just never got the Russians. We decided they weren't serious and they couldn't do anything about it. This whole Russian nationalistic streak that runs through that country, combined with the Russian Orthodox Church, we just decided it couldn't be serious, so we were going to ignore it. This is what happens when you make policy in a vacuum. People that live in Washington don't get outside the Beltway unless they go to London or something like that. They don't know what the Russians think. I mean, this just been ignored.
So I saw a piece on, I think it was on the BBC. Yeah, it was on the BBC of a young Russian military cadets in their schools, like VMI equivalent over here. They were being interviewed about NATO's expansion, and they just basically says, you know, it's unacceptable to have NATO right up on our borders. And
we decided not to take that seriously. Don't ask me why. Both, you know, Republicans and Democrats, how could they be serious? I mean, you know, everybody should be in NATO. Maybe we'll let Russia in NATO one day. But it's these delusions that govern Washington that are driven by domestic considerations. No one listens when it comes to policy. No one listens to the people actually assigned that talk to the Russians every day. Hey, this isn't going to fly. Embassy Moscow is just ignored.
Well, apparently nobody was watching when the Europeans put this situation, this zero-sum game to the Ukrainians by saying, you know, you either join the EU or Russia, but there's no middle ground. And that's, of course, prompted Putin to issue the same ultimatum to Yanukovych. It's either
they played right into his strong suit. Putin completely miscalculated him. They forgot 2008, ignored that. You know, what's Ossetia? You know, it's a country. You know, it's amazing. I find this over and over again when we turn a deaf ear to strange parts of the world.
Well, just in closing, then, do you think that there is any way to stop Putin? Obviously, he's eating Obama's lunch, and the U.S. has been caught flat-footed, as we mentioned, this is hardly over. I mean, when you suggested earlier,
it's not just hardly over. It's where will it stop?
Right.
I mean, will it stop at Moldova? What effect will this have on Poland, on the rest of Eastern Europe, on Russia? You know, I can't predict. Because I don't know what goes on in Putin's mind.
Right, but at the end of the day, it seems to me that when the West gets its act together, if the dust settles, and Putin, say, settles for the eastern half of the Dnieper and carves off half of Ukraine, I imagine that in the Baltic states and in Poland and other countries and in the what's left of Ukraine, will invest heavily in their military, won't they? And so won't we have another Cold War type of situation?
Cold War never went away. It was always there under the embers, under the ashes, hot embers, whatever you call it. It never went away.
So in other words, this is just another ending to the Cold War, if indeed it is, right? We're not even sure that it's going to end.
There's nothing messier than the breakup of an empire. And including the Russian, just like the Ottoman Empire broke up and we're living with Islamic fundamentalism. It's all part of the same phenomenon. And how it breaks up, there's no predicting it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Baer.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who is a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq and Lebanon. He is now an intelligence analyst at CNN and the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And it strikes me as a something of an irony here that you have your former boss, Henry Kissinger, suggesting that NATO should not have moved eastward and particularly should not offer membership to Ukraine. And on the other hand, you have Democratic national security officials and presidents responsible for the eastward movement of NATO. So I've often wondered whether Democratic hawks are more dangerous than Republican hawks.
Often. and what's most dangerous, of course, is that's not recognized in the Democratic constituency and certainly not by Washington in general. But Henry, I think, always had a much more acute, much more historical perspective on the interests of the old Soviet Union, of Russia as a great power, and of the importance of the buffer of Eastern Europe and of that area, which was, after all, traditionally ceded as an area of influence and interest for Russia, whoever sat in the Kremlin.
So would you agree with Bob Baer then that the Cold War didn't really end and that we completely misunderstood the collapse of Russia, that it wasn't over, that we thought it was over, but they certainly didn't?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I think there was a quite climactic moment, certainly in the first years of the old Yeltsin regime, when the United States had incredibly marvelous opportunity to fashion a new relationship with a new Russia, and as you know, that was a period fraught with awful abuses by American policy, by the famous Harvard economists, some of whom ended up in the Obama administration, Larry Summers and others. It was a moment when the United States might have applied all of the lessons of the Cold War. Instead, I think we made a series of blunders that led to our present predicament. I find it ironic that there is so much criticism now of Obama for his handling of the Ukrainian crisis, when in fact, of course, he's dealing with the legacy not only of George W. Bush but of Bill Clinton. I thought it was ironic too that Hillary Clinton was credited with taking the lead in the reset of of policy toward Russia, when in fact what she was resetting were the blunders of her own husband's presidency. So this is a long history of I think of misjudgment and of abuse of the power that came to the United States. In the wake of that collapse, there was an opportunity, I think, to treat the fallen Soviet Union and the suffering Russian people, and they were indeed suffering by the early 1990s, in a much more statesmanlike and generous way. They're going to be, as we now are finding out the hard way, a major factor in the geopolitics of the 21st century. They are enormously powerful and gifted. They are a great power. They will be for the foreseeable future, regardless of what happens in energy politics or anything else. And it was in our interest as a superpower to make that transition as gentle and as generous as possible, and we did not.
And indeed, it would seem that there was only a very narrow window there when the liberals were in charge in Russia, they blew it because they didn't get any support from our side. We basically had a policy of austerity, the same kind of insanity that's gripped the economy recently. You know,
we imposed that, and this is difficult for progressives and liberals to admit. I think there were moments of insight by the first Bush administration, the first Bush presidency. George H.W. I think had a more sophisticated view of what was happening inside Russia, but he was also captive to a lot of the most atavistic forces in the American government and bureaucracy. You know, that austerity was not only the result of the Harvard economists, it was an agreed policy from the Pentagon and from the intelligence community and a lot of other people, but I think it was a genuine tragedy. And of course, you're living with the aftermath of that now. Vladimir Putin is very much a child of that and a political phenomenon of that period. And the pride, the anger, the resentment, and the bravado with which the Russian people are now greeting all of this is, of course, the result of the humiliation and of much of the suffering that went on in that period.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So I've heard analysts suggest that in many ways Russia is suffering from PTSD, a geopolitical form of PTSD, because of that massive humiliation of being one day a superpower and the next day begging for international help. And Putin himself experienced that firsthand because he was in the KGB in East Germany, it all collapsed around him. So what's your sense then, just moving forward? Obviously, we've been taunting the wounded bear, pushing and the stupidest thing. I don't know how much you can blame Obama for this, but the EU forcing this situation on Ukraine by saying you're either with us or with Russia, which then in turn prompted Putin to say to Yanukovych, you're either with me or the EU. There's no middle ground. And that has led to this crisis. Was our side not watching the ball? Why did we let the Europeans force this zero-sum situation?
You know, I think this is true, Ian, not only in Eastern Europe vis-a-vis the Russians. It's true, obviously, in the Middle East and elsewhere, to some extent in Asia. You've got an activist president who in real life is behaving in a very passive and pacifist way. I think that they weren't keeping their eye on the ball. I think they did cede a lot of authority. I mean, you did have this claque of neocons surviving in the State Department. I mean, the Newland circle. There was a lot of manipulation there, and you know, we've always had, we've long had a very strong covert presence in the successor states. Most of those regimes were created in the aftermath of the fall of the communist world. Were created by some degree of American intervention. So there was a proprietary interest, and I think what the EU was allowed to do was a very, very serious blunder. I mean, this reaction by Moscow is just, I mean, in my view, in terms of the history of Russia and the sacrifices that they have made over the past century because of the politics of Eastern and Central Europe, was so utterly predictable, you know, almost inevitable. Nothing in geopolitics is inevitable, but this was really as close as you can get. And I don't think the White House was paying much attention any more than they were paying attention to what the outcome was going to be when Mubarak fell in Egypt, and the Morsi government did what it has done, any more than they were paying much attention to Syria. These blunders that Obama has been criticized for are, they're not simply one or two. It's a rather long list.
Well, Roger Morris, so this leads me to this apparent disconnect in the polls that show only 19% of Americans want a more aggressive and interventionist foreign policy. In other words, American people want the Obama foreign policy. But at the same time, Americans are expressing unhappiness that the U.S. is not doing more to help the victims of aggression in Syria and in Ukraine. How do you explain that disconnect?
Well, I think there's a genuine national fatigue, and there ought to be. There ought to be a genuine national aversion for some time to boots on the ground and to the kind of intervention that you saw under George W. Bush. I think that tragedy, I think, has penetrated the national consciousness. We know we cannot influence events as they presume to do with military force alone, but that leaves a host of things that a government can do that don't involve a military intervention or direct violent acts. The United States certainly could have acted much sooner to understand and to back the more secular and responsible democratic forces in Syria. Instead, of course, we relatively starved them and ignored them and left them to face the inevitable, predictable, radical element pretty much alone. We're doing some things now to come back to support them with military assistance. We could have done much, much more in humanitarian aid. You know, I mean, politically, this country still wields enormous influence in the world, certainly financially and economically and diplomatically, which this administration has not used very effectively. It's fond of talking about soft power and seems to me very inept in actually using it. Obama is constantly posing this dichotomy between either, you know, my critics simply want to go to war and I'm not going to do that. We know that's insane. So the only alternative to that is pretty much doing nothing, or the kind of endless equivocation and ambivalence that seems to mark his view of a number of areas.
Well, just though in this post 9/11 world where we're spending more on the military than we ever did during the worst and most dangerous period of the Cold War. And now we're spending more, much, much more on intelligence than we ever did at the worst period of the Cold War. And look what we get in exchange. Bob Baer was saying earlier that he's got very good sources who told him that Secretary Kerry simply had no information that there was going to be a Russian invasion of Crimea and a stealth invasion of eastern Ukraine, that he was completely blindsided and that Lavrov lied to him and he had no intelligence to...
Well, we were blinded there in part. I mean, you may remember that I guess it was maybe a year and a half ago, The Guardian published a rather lengthy dispatch about how much U.S. intelligence, how much the NSA and the agency had known about a G20 summit in 2009 and had eavesdropped on everybody's BlackBerries, and there have been other sort of random dispatches about American electronic surveillance and how effective it was and what a boon to policymakers, and this drove the Russians, among others, crazy, of course. I mean, my God, the defense ministry in Moscow is turning to typewriters again, doing a lot of work on in hard copy paper rather than electronics and computers, which can be hacked and surveilled. I think a lot of this was given away. You know, I mean, Kerry just said it at a private meeting, I guess it was the Trilateral Commission, that we could be sure that the Russians were manipulating events in eastern Ukraine because we were eavesdropping on their communications. But basically, I think Putin went dark here, as most of the Russian military and their intelligence establishment has advised, because they did know that they were subject, in the old system, they were subject to very intense American surveillance. But this is, you know, this has been going on for a very, very long time. This is not new. We've been blanketing the planet with this, and I can tell you in my experience in the government, we're equal opportunity snoops. We don't discriminate offhand between our friends and our enemies, and we used to listen to our allies every bit as much as we listen to our adversaries, and that of course always causes embarrassment as well. I think the Obama problem, I think, traces to two things that haven't been talked about very much. One is this general expectation that we had in 2008 that we were getting a more sophisticated, knowledgeable president than we actually got. I think we assumed that he knew more about governance. He knew a great deal about campaigning. He was a marvelous politician. He knew much, much less about Washington, about how the government really worked, and certainly far less about the Pentagon and the intelligence community, this glandular explosion that had taken place under W in that world, in the world of intelligence and the military-industrial world in general. I think Obama did not have a good grip on, and that explains a lot of what's happened in Afghanistan and elsewhere. The second thing, it seems to me, is that there is there's also a kind of a general assumption that Obama does have and answers to the major problems that confront us in the world, and neither he nor his advisors came with a very coherent foreign policy. If you go back now and look at the campaign in 2008 and look at the positions that he took vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton and then again against Senator McCain and the general, this was not a well thought out, coherent foreign policy that he presented. It had much more to do with tone and tenor and with America's standing, restoring its prestige and good name in the world, et cetera, et cetera. It ended up, of course, being a continuation of policies, especially in South Asia and also in the Middle East that the previous administration had followed. And he brought around him I would call him probably the least competent, the least sophisticated bunch of national security advisors that we've had in a very long time. I mean, you remember General Jones, James Jones, and then succeeded by Tom Donilon, who was at best a sort of second string hack for the Clintons, and now by Susan Rice, who has her own rather checkered past. Hillary Clinton, whatever her other virtues may have been, was not the most talented or able Secretary of State that Barack Obama could have assembled. But this was a government that very much reflected his own sense of self and of and his command, his insistence, as presidents do, that he wanted this to be his own foreign policy. So I think we've suffered from arrogance and incompetence at the same time, and it's not, after all, unlike what's happened in domestic politics. He's benefited, as he does in domestic politics, by the poverty, the intellectual poverty of his opposition. I mean, he doesn't. If Obama has a flawed foreign policy, the Republicans have virtually none. And the history of what happened in Iraq and then Afghanistan so discredits what was once a Republican foreign policy that he can coast, and I would doubt seriously, Ian, that foreign affairs is going to be much of an issue in the 2016 campaign. I think that the former Secretary of State, who will certainly, if she wants it, have the nomination, will not make that a major issue. I don't see any of the Republicans really offering much of a challenge.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, and his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Omoyele Sowore, who is a human rights and pro-democracy campaigner. He is the founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalism which supplies videos, photos, news stories, and commentaries that expose official corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Omoyele Sowore.
Thank you for having me.
And over this weekend, there have been demonstrations all around the world, in Los Angeles, in New York, in London, around the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Various signs were held up, Bring Them Home, Not For Sale, and African Lives Matter. There's also, of course, a sit-in protest underway in Abuja, organized by dozens of mothers and women in support of the release of these young women. There's 223 schoolgirls are still held by Boko Haram out of the 276 girls that were seized on April the 14th. So this certainly doesn't cast the Nigerian government in a particularly good light, does it? The fact that they, one, were helpless to stop this kidnapping that went on for a long time, and two, they don't seem to have any plans or any ability to get the girls back.
Well, that's correct. Also, the Nigerian government actually did not react to this kidnapping until it became a major global scandal in which groups and individuals were protesting outside of Nigeria. I travel on the ground to Nigeria on a regular basis, and I was in Nigeria until last Saturday, and there was no sign in Nigeria of any concern for the plight of these girls until I got back to the United States and started hearing a lot of loud protests and noises from celebrities and individuals saying, bring back the girls. And I was shocked that there was nothing on the ground in Abuja, where I was for 2 days, concerning the plight of the girls.
Well, you have your problems with the Nigerian government and also with Boko Haram, the Islamist, I guess you can call them fanatics. I mean, they're against the translation of their name is Western education is sinful. They believe that women should stay at home and serve their men and not get educated. And Boko Haram have threatened to bomb your headquarters of your offices of Sahara Reporters in New York. And I take it the Nigerian government, you've also upset them. Do you have to sort of sneak into the country? Is that how you get in?
Absolutely. The best way to describe it in a very funny way is that because of the nation of acrimony and enmity against our style of reporting, we had to create our own airport to get into Nigeria and out of Nigeria. But it's understood because we speak truth to society, and this means speaking truth to government and non-state actors like Boko Haram, where we've exposed a lot of their tactics. But it is very sad that despite our efforts and work and revelations about their activities, the government has done nothing about them. But we've also exposed the atrocious corruption by the Nigerian government that has been fueling not only Boko Haram Islamic militancy in the north, but it's also, don't forget, some kind of militancy in the south as well against oil companies, the kidnapping in several parts of Nigeria's, you know, organized crime all over the place. So this has been the kind of work we do that naturally gets Nigerian government upset against us and naturally gets non-state actors like Boko Haram who have been exploiting the lack of, you know, governance in Nigeria as well against us. So it's true. It's a very tough job because each time we do our jobs very well, we offend both state actors and non-state actors.
Well, it would seem, though, that this government, which is corrupt, amazingly so, there was a recent case of the head of the Nigerian Central Bank who discovered that $30 million were missing? $30 billion were missing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and instead of investigating the Nigerian state oil company for its embezzlement or this lack of transparency, shall we say, he got fired, the central banker. And in terms of dealing with this kidnapping of these schoolgirls, all the Nigerian government done so far is set up a committee presided over by an army general. So what did the president, Jonathan Goodluck, say in his address to the Nigerian nation tonight in Nigeria?
I don't know what he's going to say, but I'm not expecting anything new. I think all of it is reactive. They're reacting to public pressure. They're reacting to international social media and media pressure. And typically when he does his media chats, he does with pre-selected journalists around the world, I mean around the country, who ask him, you know, predetermined questions. And, of course, there are predetermined answers. We have applied several times to use social media to participate in this press media chats, and we've been denied all the times we applied because we want to be able to use Skype, for example, to participate and ask him questions. And they won't allow us. So this is, and to talk about the former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, last night he was prevented from traveling to Saudi Arabia to observe Lesser Hajj because he's still a thorn on the side of President Jonathan and his corrupt TV elites, including the Minister of Petroleum Resources, who have been involved, who the Central Bank governor indicted directly, exposed directly, revealed directly, have been involved in stealing billions of dollars. So, you know, they didn't like him because he came up with his revelations. And they're yet to address the revelations. They're covering it up.
So he was denied exit from the country to go to
last night. Yeah, to our website, thesaudireporters.com,
to the pilgrimage
in Saudi Arabia. Yes.
In Saudi Arabia. Now again, I'm speaking with Omoyele Sowore, who is a human rights and pro-democracy campaigner. He's the founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalism which supplies videos, photos, news stories, and commentaries that expose official corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. Now, Nigeria will be hosting the World Economic Summit on Africa in a few days, right? And the Chinese leader is heading there. What kind of security guarantees is this government able to provide, given the rash of bombings from Boko Haram, not to mention, of course, the kidnapping of the girls?
Well, I don't think anybody who is serious about security would, you know, we go to Nigeria for this World Economic Forum, or Africa's Davos, as they call it. But it is the reason why they are even reacting at all to the kidnapping of the girls. As I speak with you, already this morning the president met with, after 19 days or 20 days, met with the principal of the high school where the girls were abducted. And this is part of the pressure that they are reacting to from the rest of the world, because they want to seriously have this economic forum to show that somehow Nigeria, having rebased the economy, is doing well economically. But that is meant for the businessmen outside. It's meant for people who are interested in telling lies about the Nigerian economy. But for the average Nigerian person, they know this is all a scam. In 2 weeks, there have been bombing of a major bus station in Abuja, same place, maybe like 10 meters apart. And so if you're flying into Abuja, I wish you good luck. I think, going by the way they operate, they will secure the airport, they will secure the, you know, conference venue, and they might have a successful conference. But if anybody is fooled by the outcome of such very, very well choreographed, deceptive feeling that Nigeria is safe because a conference successfully took place in Abuja, then of course they need to seriously examine their brains.
So, Omoyele Sowore, tell me then, Secretary of State Kerry spoke out about these kidnapped girls in a speech in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. He said, let me be clear, the kidnapping of hundreds of children by Boko Haram is an unconscionable crime. So but maybe some of those kind of statements have got the Nigerian government on the defensive, and tonight in Nigeria, President Goodluck Jonathan is going to address the nation, but I don't know that he's going to offer very much. My understanding is that the girls, first of all, this kidnapping took place over many hours, and nothing was done about it. It makes you wonder about the security services' competence, and then they drove these convoys of trucks back and forth as they took these girls. Some of the girls managed to escape and run into the bush. But my understanding is that most of the girls have been taken across the border into Cameroon. Is that your understanding?
You know, there's a lot of reporting about what's happening. Nobody knows exactly what's happening, but we are sufficiently close enough to some of these atrocities in terms of being citizen reporters, and we create citizen reports from our, you know, across Nigeria, especially these militants. The militants have no reason to panic to take the split the girls apart. They have a functioning camp. They have like a garrison where they operate from. And the military guys know them. And they have also released videos upon videos showing that they are not on the run. It is the Nigerian military that's on the run. So they have no reason to actually spread the girls. And from what we have heard from the girls, some of the girls that escaped that we spoke to, including from a Nigerian senator yesterday, they are all in the same camp. In fact, one of the girls said she was allowed to leave because she told one of the militants that she was the only daughter of her parents. And they said, oh, yeah, you can go. So the Boko Haram militants have no reason, because they're very, very comfortably in charge of the militancy. They're in charge of the atrocities they commit. They're comfortable in their skin, in their turf, in their bones. They have no reason to split the girls apart. They have a place where they operate from inside of Nigeria. The leader of Boko Haram said last week that he often comes to Abuja, that's the federal capital, and leaves. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. So what most of what you're reading about, the girls being split and being separated and being disrupted all over the world, is not exactly true. I think a lot of it is just speculative. They have no reason to be afraid of the Nigerian military. And the Nigerian military has shown that they are afraid of Boko Haram as opposed to the opposite.
Well, I have heard reports that Boko Haram is protected at the highest level within the Nigerian government. Is that your understanding?
I would think that they enjoy some high-level protection and patronage. I think Boko Haram has political, it has economic and cultural and religious connotation and also ideological connotations. There is no way Nigeria would be having the kind of audacious militancy that Boko Haram has offered without protection or support or patronage at the highest levels. You know, just to break it down very easily, it was the same way the Niger Delta militants enjoyed the highest level protection when they were blowing up pipelines and kidnapping people and killing soldiers in the Niger Delta region, until they came to a dialogue and agreement that, you know, they would also be part of sharing the Nigerian loot. And the moment that agreement was reached between them and the highest level of government, the militancy just subsided. And a few Niger Delta militants that tried to revive the Niger Delta militancy were crushed immediately, because the understanding of the main militants and their backers at the highest level was that, you know, Niger Delta militancy was over. So I would believe that something similar is happening with Boko Haram.
So in other words, they're putting pressure on the government to make a deal so that they can join in the stealing of the treasury.
Absolutely. You can just quickly learn from what the Niger Delta militants are doing now. That's some of the richest guys in Nigeria in the last 2 years with former militants who were engaged in kidnapping, killing, abduction, and, sabotage of Nigerian oil infrastructure. They're doing very well now. Some of them even have private jets.
So these are the MEND terrorists, are they? MEND?
Some of them MEND. You know, right. They had different AKs. Yeah.
Well, Omoyele Sowore, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and hope to talk to you in the future.
Again, I've been speaking with Omoyele Sowore, who is a human rights and pro-democracy campaigner. He is the founder and publisher of the much-cited SaharaReporters.com, a website of citizen journalism which supplies videos, photos, news stories, and commentaries that expose official corruption and abuse in Nigeria's government. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.